January 28, 1977. Prominent artists, writers, film directors, actors, and musicians were invited to the National Theater for, quote, celebration, unquote. When they were all in the theater, the doors were locked, and they were instructed to sign a document supporting the, quote, fraternal help of the Soviet Army, unquote, in 1968. That is the invasion. Most signed. Bad news, good news. My dad is in the hospital. He couldn't attend. I'm almost sure he wouldn't have signed. Dot, dot, dot. What would I have done?
An incident from the life of an artist in Czechoslovakia when it was behind the Iron Curtain might make us ask, what would we have done? I'm Norman Gilliland.
And I'm Emily Auerbach. This is University of the Year.
For anyone born after 1990, the Iron Curtain and the Cold War are history, maybe as remote as World War II or the Great Depression. Artist and author Peter Cease, who grew up in Czechoslovakia when it was under Soviet domination, is telling younger readers about his experience in an unusual way with a graphic novel. As an artist, how did he cope with censorship in Czechoslovakia? What finally prompted him to leave it for the United States? And what did he give up by leaving? How does his experience in Czechoslovakia affect his thinking now that he's an American citizen? And we'll also discover some things about that up-and-coming genre, the graphic novel. Peter Cease's latest book is The Wall, Growing Up Behind the Iron Curtain, published by Farrar, Straus, and Giroux in 2007.
Welcome to University of the Year.
Nice to be here.
I found this book kind of an amazing experience, not like any other book that I've read. It's kind of an adult picture book, really. It's mostly illustrations, but a lot of different text around it. And I was wondering, because this is radio where it's hard to
right.
see the images, although we, you know, obviously people can look it up on the web and see some sample illustrations, but could you just describe for us this book, The Wall, Growing Up Behind the Iron Curtain, what sort of images you use, what kind of book you would call this?
Well, I'm so very happy that you call it graphic novel because that wasn't my intention or plan. I did many books in the genre of picture or illustrated books. And what happened here, I think I had so many memories and so many things I wanted to tell because the initial idea was really that I realized that my children know nothing about where I grew up or how I grew up, and when they go to Prague now, it's just a pleasant place with happy relatives. And when I tried to talk to them, they just wouldn't make sense, so I thought I have to draw it. And all these selective little memories, there were so many that I started to pile them up, and I could see that I can't fit that many in one page. And because the regime I grew up in was so restricted and the wall in the title is like made of bricks, I started to put them in little boxes to show that everything was under some sort of control. And then I have pictures of when things got more free or looser, when the pictures sort of open up and don't have this boxed sort of idea. But it's wonderful that, I grew up with comic strips my grandfather brought from Chicago before Second World War. And so if somebody thinks I did a comic book or a graphic novel, I'm just absolutely happy about that.
And your audience, when you were writing this, besides for your own children, did you see this as a book for adults, for children, for both?
You know, I don't ever see this, and that's a big problem because as soon as any book is out, people say, what age group is it for? But then again, if I go around the schools or signing books, sometimes you meet some child who's 4 years old and they read book on the level of 15, and then you meet somebody who's 25 and they don't read at all. And part of the reason I even dared to do this book was because I was awarded MacArthur Grant. So I thought, and they say, like, there are no strings attached, but we hope you will continue to do important work for people. So I thought this is an important story because I witnessed it, I experienced it, and this is a story, I think, for to be remembered. And so I didn't think about it that much, but I went through three or four versions of this book just because there were lots of people who didn't know where this book is going. And they were doubtful, and they said, who will ever want to buy a book like this? At one point, I was even offered to go to expand the book into 100 pages, make it really into proper graphic novel, which I think for graphic novel enthusiasts should be a little smaller. And the French did it smaller because they think graphic novel enthusiasts in France and Belgium will buy it. But the editor, which was in the same publishing house, said, I want you to expand all the dark corners and all the suspicious and lies and all immoral life. And he gave me as a sample book, wonderful book from a woman from Montreal who did a book about her mother who's living in Hungary. She's Jewish. She tries to save the children, goes to the countryside. Then the Germans come, rape her. Then the Russians come, rape her. And it was a heartbreaking story, but I realized that after 20-something years doing children's book, this is as far as I want to go into darkness in this book, and I didn't want to really try to explain what was the whole Soviet system.
And I think the broader picture is probably more effective here. You do an interesting thing, though, interwoven through all of the pictures and the short text. You have these excerpts from your diary. They go back to 1954 when you would have been 5 years old. Did you really start keeping a diary at the age of five?
This was really devised. I kept diary when I became like a teenager. I was drawing pictures when I was allowed to leave the country, and I would draw everything, which is now very interesting for me to see. These are more memories of the childhood and things which are true and sort of refined what I was thinking, and to show what happens if the child is born into political system which doesn't allow the parents to really say this is how it is, and the child is being brainwashed, which I think will stay with me for the rest of my life, because I think once you brainwash, you just brainwash, and you can try very, very hard to get over it. But I remember when I was on the jury duty, I was being selected for the jury duty, and I got into this very close selection, and the judge said, and all the cases, there were like three cases of the police and the...
This would be in New York?
This was in New York downtown, drug dealers against police. And he said, does anybody have a problem to be on this jury? And I lifted my arm and I said, look, I know this is a good police. This is American police. This is the police which is serving the people. But I grew up in the country with the bad police. And whatever I do, if I see the police car, my first reaction is I get scared, and then I go, oh, wait a minute, it's a good police. But I have to go through that process. It's not like my children who wouldn't even think about it. And so then the judge said, you can go home now, you are damaged forever. And it's sort of true.
Well, in the illustrations you use in your book of the police, the image of ominous-looking pig figure.
Right.
And they sometimes are very large and lurking in corners and just waiting to pounce.
Because I still cannot understand like how people just... Because I don't think all of them did it, because that's the whole problem with that whole system, that I think in 1917 or something, when people were idealized, they were being poor, that would be people who really believe. But I think what I experienced, especially when things started to make sense to me, that lots of people were so corrupt and did it because of certain sadism or power. And I think the police was a big part of it. And there was a whole thing going on when really they kept people scared. And it's interesting, because when you live in it, you think this is how it is in my life. This is how it is all over the world, probably. And then when you come to different culture and you realize this is not part of their life, and that people have really undeniable rights, which are liberty, justice, and pursuit of happiness, that this is really awful, because just every day you would have to carry with you your identity card, and if you didn't have it already, you were in trouble. And you must have had a picture in your identity card which was truthful to what you look like. So that means when people started to grow long hair, the police could take them and cut their hair, because they said, this is not what you look like in your identity
card.
Women
couldn't dye their hair, I assume?
Nothing. No, you couldn't have a mustache or facial hair, because it, and the trouble was sometimes if you grew it before the time, you could get a photograph, and it was like, it was no digital art or anything. It was like old photographer, it took for weeks. You had to be hiding because you couldn't accomplish this.
You better hope that was a really great picture. That
so
they
this gave the system power over you, but also you had a page where you had your, with the stamp where you are employed, and everybody had a responsibility or duty, or it was a law that you must be employed. So let's say that was the problem with the dissidents when they couldn't get a job because nobody would give them a job. They could be immediately arrested because they didn't have a job. And it was like these Catch-22 Kafka sort of things which seem sort of like absurd, but they were a question of survival, really.
Could you read your opening page and describe what's on the page, you know, the image that you have of the child starting to draw, but then the little words around the image? You could just read the main sentence.
Yeah.
And then describe for those who don't have your book.
Well, I should also say that this book went through many, many changes. And this is sort of simplification of things because the first page and last page show the character who really all he wants to do is to dream and draw, and that's what he wants. And he gets into circumstances when things get sort of confusing a little bit.
And he's naked on this first
page. And he's
page.
Naked because he's just born, which probably no baby would get a pencil and draw, but I want to say this
metaphorically
is the,
speaking.
Yes, this is the beautiful little child which doesn't know what system, if it's war, if it's peace, if, what continent. And he's holding the pencil because then in the end of the book, as an old person, also holds the pencil. And I say now, as long as he could remember, he had loved to draw. And then as a frame, I say, just to explain the whole sort of frame of this book, and that's Iron Curtain, the boundary that symbolically, ideologically, and physically divided Europe in two separate areas after the World War II. Cold War, the geopolitical, ideological, and economic struggle that emerged between capitalism and communism from 1945 to 1991. Communism, and this is very simplified because you could put a very big paragraph, the ideology of the Soviet Union and other countries, a system of government in which the state controls all social and economic activity.
And you've got the baby depicted with very large, wide eyes.
Right, because I think babies like are so eager to see the world and see how the world is. And that's really what is upsetting for me older and older I get. And because when you are a baby, you really make no choices. You just look for milk or love or family. And that's fine if you get it. It's wonderful. But then you come to the age when you start to make sense of the world and you go to school. And all of a sudden, if somebody tells you, from tomorrow we have to kill all the birds. You know, like and people can tell you anything. And if I look back, I realize that we were told so many things which were not true, yet they make you somehow feel, because if you want to be a good student, if you want to be a good child, then you take it, that's how it is. And I, as an example, I always say, like, we were told since second grade that only the bad people, the awful people, criminals and murderers would go and leave the country, go somewhere else because then they would be traitors. And so that's with you for 15 years. And then at some point you realize, I can't take it anymore. And you want to leave and it's impossible because there is a big fence or wall. So you start to think, how shall I do it? But in the same time, you're feeling guilty because you know you're one of those bad people they told you about in those 15 years. And then you succeed and leave, and they put you through incredible sort of pressure, like, how come you didn't come back immediately, return? And then you make the decision, and it's so hard because you're starting anew, and sometimes some people had wives and children. Yet, then I found out when they went through that process of the transition, let's say waiting for immigration visa or whatever, they would still feel guilty about what they did. Even they tell you now, no, I hated them and whatever. And they had these dreams. Everybody had a dream that they got on the train or plane by mistake and landed back in Prague. And the police was waiting for them and reaching for them and saying, so what have you done? And it disappeared after the wall came down, really. And that's just so unnecessary because then I was listening to some program about, and they said the first right of people is a freedom of movement. So as a human being, you should have a freedom of movement when you decide, I can't make a living in this place, so I go live in Kansas. Yet this was the country surrounded by the fence, which people couldn't cross. And still you were made feel guilty. If some sports person would decide to leave, it was a big article in the paper. How could she have done this to, if it was Ivan Lendl? Or there was a wonderful woman who was a javelin thrower, and she fell in love with American. I think she won like medal in Melbourne. And he won medal for United States, and they fell in love. And it was such a disaster because this is like 1956 or something. And they wouldn't give her a celebration because she was seen with the American athlete. And then she had to somehow, he came to marry her in Prague, but they made it all look very, very bad. And then she left with him for America, and she didn't dare to come back for, I think, until now. And now she's an old lady, and she had a gold medal from Melbourne, but just because she fell in love with American, she was a bad person, which is ridiculous.
At the same time, it was very hard for many years for outsiders to come into Czechoslovakia.
Well, I think on purpose, because it was exchange of information, and it was dangerous, of course.
Now, the Soviets took over Czechoslovakia, what, about a year before you were born?
Yeah, a year before I was born, and I wanted to make this book more like explaining what happened, so I keep it like I was born when they took over. It was a complex thing because, of course, Czechoslovakia was was a disillusion after Munich Agreement, which sort of gave Czechoslovakia to Hitler. So there wasn't very much trust, France, England. And General Patton came all the way to Pilsen, but Roosevelt and Stalin, they made deal in Yalta that all these countries would be under the influence of Russians because they thought that Stalin's so afraid of Germany that he wanted to have like a bumper zone. And they insisted in Yalta that they have a free elections. And Stalin agreed, but they made a wonderful sort of plot when the elections were sort of stolen. And that's also part of, I would hope if people are interested in this book, that they find out how the democratic system, really, because the communists were playing the game of democracy, but they already took over because they had some ministry, so they took over the ministry of the police, interior, and army. So they were like sort of ready to pounce, and then there was this coup d'etat in February 48. And this still would be okay because people thought there would be more free elections and it's just a system. But what then Stalin's idea, because Stalin since 34 was so, it was a cult of personality. So they had these arranged trials that happened in Hungary first, I think. And they would mostly choose people who were of Jewish descent. And these were high-ranking communists. And they made like these purges and show trials, which if you read about them now, you read that these people were so dedicated to the cause of communism that they knew they are innocent and they knew what's happening, that somebody needs some victims, that in front of the judge they agreed that they were bad and then they were hanged. And this was in the paper. And I remember as a child this sort of gloomy, it was this whole gloomy feeling because the parents wouldn't explain it. I had some relatives who went to prison, which I mentioned in my diaries, which were always, nobody would talk about them, or if they would talk about them, my grandmother would speak in German. And we didn't quite know what they did, and they were like dark people because nobody explained that this was so stupid. Like this one cousin of my father was 20 years old. He was playing on the volleyball team and they just said, when we go and play in England, because sports teams would still travel occasionally, he said, let's stay there. And then somebody said, they said they will stay in England. And on that pretext, when they were boarding the plane, and this is something 1954 or something, then he was arrested, and he, well, I say I think here because I was a child that he was sentenced for life, but he would be sentenced for, let's say, 15 years. But still he went to prison, and he did hard labor, and I remember meeting him then, because then, before 68, they released all these people. I met him, and I met some pilots, because these young pilots, Czech pilots, were in England saving London, and they were 1920, and because they were on the Western Front, they also were in prison for some false pretext. And they worked on hard labor for 12, 13 years, and it changed them. They were sort of completely broken people who said they used to be in England when they were young and handsome, and now they were tired and broken people who slept in cold. And that was all. All these things I didn't realize when I was really living them. And then when you get older and start to think about it, you just find it unnecessary, awful, the human condition, what people can. And this, I thought, is a valuable lesson for anybody. I don't suspect that somebody would be taking over America, but I think when people are born free, and that was a message to my children who are, I'm so proud that they are sort of, they wouldn't take anything from anybody. But if something would happen, if somebody would take over our little town and say from tomorrow everybody wears blue, now they wouldn't agree already. But if they would be 2 years old, 3 years old, and the parents would say, oh my God, if you don't want trouble, let's put blue dresses on everybody. And then already these children growing up with the fact that they must have blue dresses, so they take it as a fact of life. And that can happen with many things, I think.
You write here, after drawing whatever he wanted to at home, he drew what he was told to at school in the book. Tell us about art at school.
Well, the pictures on the walls at school, the whole education with Russian language and political sort of history, it was all geared towards the Soviet Union's version of how things happen in the world. And the same went for the classes of art when we would draw whatever was the subject and everything, all these political celebrations. So we would have 1st of May, we would have November
7th.
Yeah, and it was like, I don't even remember all of them, but they were constant. And I remember as a children, we were happy that I think once in 2 weeks we would march from school to some movie house where they would show some Soviet film about some... It was usually to do with war. That's why I was amazed that I have so many drawings. As a child, I drew constantly airplanes. But I think it was also because it was after the war and the Soviets lost so many people, so they were making these epics. And each film screening would be in Russian, and we would have these groups of young pioneers playing trumpets. And that was our dream to be. I played trumpet, I think, in 2 of them, and it was such a privilege to do that. And the same thing when we got into 3rd grade, the best ones, but almost everybody except some social cases, which were absolutely uncontrollable. And as I say, my friend who was gypsy, and they had like 18 children, so they said he's not a good example. So we were privileged to become young pioneers, and they would take us to Lenin Museum in Prague, and they would again play trumpets and drums, and we would get red scarves. And since then, we were proud to wear the scarves, but there was also every morning there would be like somebody making dots who did forget a scarf. So I would have like a checkered shirt, and I thought this doesn't go with the scarf, but scarf was put on everything, and you had to be a proud sort of pioneer with your scarf all the time. So then people started to exchange scarves. If they met somebody from Germany, they had blue scarves. I don't know why. The Polish had red and white scarves, and the Russians had silk scarves. So it was like we started to collect, like, who's got what scarves. And people used to get signatures on the scarf, which then ended up with somebody coming, I remember, with having written Elvis on it, because some older, I think it was the beginnings already of, like, the rock and roll sort of creeping in. And the teacher was very nice because she somehow made him exchange the scarf. She could have made it into an enormous problem. So this was the school when we just obeyed. And it was like, again, in every culture that the parents would say, well, you have to be a good student so you would get to the middle school and you would get to the college. And so you do everything you can to the point that you get engaged politically, because that if you were engaged politically and the parents, there was a great difference. If your parents were well established as the political people, then you had a chance to get education and become successful. If your grandfather already owned farm, you were in big trouble. If he was a farm worker, that was much, you needed farm worker or factory worker. That was the best. Or you needed, like, one parent would be from the working class and the other parent, maybe she was a hairdresser or something. That was okay. But once there was some property involved, like somebody would have a bakery. And then it was going up to people who owned the factory. There was you could never think about studying.
I have to wonder how you were taught literature.
We would read whatever was the selection, but in the beginning it was really more indoctrination. There were these stories of we had, like, it was a whole, there was so many Russian heroes, and we knew all the names, and they did different deeds. Unfortunately, some of them probably were like, you know, it was really amazing what they did, because I remember it was this one girl who fought the Germans and they hanged her. But there was one guy who was a Russian soldier who would see Germans with the machine gun, and he threw his own body on the machine gun, so that way the army could advance, and he was one hero. And one hero was this person I mentioned who would notice that his father is not giving his flour. He was a farmer to the community.
So he's turning in his own father.
So he turned in his own father because his father was bad. And this was for us example to say, if you see anything bad, you come and tell us, which I think was a fear for the parents. Unfortunately, I can't go into details with them anymore because they are not here anymore. But even when they were alive, nobody wanted to really tell you how it was, because I think it was that feeling of the mother or parents to protect you, and you cannot say, why didn't you tell me? What age do you decide to tell child, this is not as it is? So my grandmother was sort of corrupting me, taking me secretly to church, showing me, like, that's St. Peter there. And that's, like, she shouldn't be doing this. But I didn't report on her.
Oh,
not a Soviet hero, that's St. Peter.
More with Peter Cease when we continue in a moment with University of the Year.
Tune in to Wisconsin Public Television tonight at 8 for the season premiere of Masterpiece Theater. In The Amazing Mrs. Pritchard, a grocery store manager takes on big-time politics with amazing results. Masterpiece Theater, The Amazing Mrs. Pritchard, tonight at 8, only on Wisconsin Public Television.
He drew tanks, he drew wars. He didn't question what he was being told. Then he found out that there were things he wasn't told. Slowly, he started to question. He painted what he wanted to in secret. He joined a rock group and painted music. Everything seemed possible. It was the Prague Spring of 1968. Then, it was all over. Russian tanks were everywhere. But out of the dark came a glimmer of hope. The Beach Boys have arrived. America to the rescue.
Peter Cease reading from his new graphic novel, The Wall, Growing Up Behind the Iron Curtain. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach, and we're looking at life behind the Iron Curtain, as it was in Czechoslovakia, in Prague in particular, when Peter Cease was growing up during the 50s and 60s and 70s. What was it that brought about that Prague Spring that we remember so well, that freeing up of life in Prague?
It's a good question, because people, when they say 1968, they think it happened 1968. I think it was happening a long time before. And it was this constant sort of, I think, of people who are so eager to know and get information and like music and like literature and like theater. They were so hungry for information that the information was getting in all different kinds of forms. And I think that was sort of like slowly eroding the whole really steel wall from the 50s. I remember there were lots of books started to be published. There were two magazines which were doing selections of the world literature, which were excellent. What happened by some very wonderful coincidence, but which also gave me obviously a completely wrong picture of America, was there was some exchange of exhibitions and events. And I mentioned in my book there were concerts of gradually of Louis Armstrong, who comes in 65, then came Ella Fitzgerald, Count Basie.
You saw Louis Armstrong.
Yeah, I saw Louis Armstrong, but I also saw him more than I have in my book, because my father was a filmmaker and great jazz aficionado. So he made films from all these concerts. So I met him in person with his wife, and I met Ella Fitzgerald, and I wasn't there for Count Basie and Duke Ellington. But these people were slowly coming, and there was a wonderful, what is amazing, what I just remember, there was a dance of Merce Cunningham's dance group with Robert Rauschenberg, who was doing stuff on the stage. There was a wonderful exhibition of American graphic arts, which I'm still trying to get a catalog of. And there was Harlem Globetrotters came, which was like, it was absolutely magic. And at that time, I think I painted Harlem Globetrotters for like a year, because it was absolutely like a dream. And then even came the college team. I think I say college team, but maybe then I found out it could have been the team which won in the Olympic Games with Bill Bradley, who was famous. So this didn't happen in 1 year, but gradually these things were being seen, and we sort of admired without any criticism anything which came from West, which was sort of funny, because if we would see a bottle of tomato ketchup, Heinz tomato ketchup, it was so beautifully designed, and we said, like, look, they squish the tomatoes and they are so red, and because it was from the West, it was so wonderful. And I think this was a combination of things, and we were so impressed with anything, then people would start to be obsessed with the blue jeans, which was a very funny story, because when there were just few old men who had maybe some brother who lived in Kansas, everybody talks about, those are the working class pens from America. This is the pens the workers were in America. So the first reaction of the communist system was good, like, because this is the clothes of the working class. But then when it became sort of symbol of, like, because people could tell, like, he must know somebody who has relatives somewhere in the West because he has blue jeans. So they would start to just talk to you because you had blue jeans and say much more than he would say otherwise. So then the principals and teachers started to have problems that it would make people not, you were not supposed to have them. And I think the same thing happened then with rock music, because the jazz was sort of allowed, the Germans called jazz the decadent music and it was banned. So the Russians really couldn't do the same. Even I don't think it sounded good to them. But again, it was introduced as the music of oppressed people, and the jazz people, after all, were sort of looking decent. They were not disturbing the peace as much as when rock came. And that's very interesting.
And you had a radio show, is that right?
That happened really in the end. I had a radio show, but it was really my self-indulgence that I did have that radio show, because what happened was that when the rock started, I had a band and everything, and my father was making some film with the producer from England who gave me about 200 records, single records more. But then that moment I became person who had the most records. And so I started to play the records because I wanted to spread the information. Then somebody noticed and said, would you like to have a radio show? And I had a little radio show, but what happened after 68, again, it wasn't like 68 happened and just finished, but it was dying down for like 3 years because the government got control again. And I have to admit that there was a radio show on the program which was very political, and they wanted to get rid of it. And they did a very smart thing, that they, instead of just completely ban it, they offered me that time slot, which would be much more avant-garde or more, I would have more English and American music. So people were happier about the music, but the man who was much stronger political voice than mine would be gone. And we are friends still today. And he told me then, he said, don't you see what they're doing? They will put your show instead of my show, and then eventually they will close your show down. And of course, I was 19, I had long hair, and I was like idol of so many people. And I sort of, it made sense what he told me, but I was still so self-indulged that I thought, I want to have that show. And then what he said happened exactly. I had a show for, I think, a year, which was very, very popular. And then, of course, I inevitably said something wrong or played some record which was wrong, and it got banned. And so I sort of bring it up every time so I don't want to look like I was a hero, that I made a terrible mistake just because of my egoism, really.
It sounds as if the issue of censorship was different, handled differently, radio versus the graphic arts. Maybe easier to get around censorship in the graphic arts?
Well, everybody was trying to get around censorship, but I think what became terrible after 68, that everything became much more sophisticated. And I think in the 50s and 60s, the system would be censoring things. And after 68, if you graduated from art school, or if you got official stamp that you are an artist, you had a responsibility to apply self-censorship. So anything you did could be used against you, and sometimes things happened by accident. It would be just that people would say the wrong word by mistake, and it came out in the context, and you could be really in trouble for life, which was incredible responsibility, because you always had to think about having, you know, family and house and wife and children who want to go to college. So this is how I think the system and the power was implied, because even if you draw a tree, I remember there was a poster of somebody who drew a tree for the poster for, there was a poster for a February theater play, and he did the bare tree with like few leaves, and people started to say, did you see that picture? It's a memory of February 1948 when they hanged people, and he was running around saying, no, these are just leaves. It's nobody hanging nowhere. Because he could see he's getting in trouble. And more he was talking about it, more people said, that's a hidden.
But the censors, at least with the graphic arts, they could take issue with it before it got out.
Exactly.
Whereas broadcasting is such an immediate thing.
Yeah, yeah.
There was, in effect, no censorship except after the fact.
Yeah, and also I think after my show was banned, and I think then everything was very often taped, and people who would be live on the air, if it was television or radio, they would really make sure that these people will not do anything wrong. And they still did. And it's still, it happened very often in the theater when something got sort of double entendre. Mm-hmm. And people started, and they enjoyed it so much, but immediately that alerted these censors. And it was a big trouble. But I even remember like going to the film called Mephisto by István Szabó. And it was about Germany and Hitler and Goering and this guy who's a Mephisto. And it somehow was fitting the political situation of that moment, and people were applauding in the movie house, and they switch on the lights, and then they said, who was applauding? And you can't, this is a film. And so there was always this thing going on of double meanings, which I, in my films, which I did the animation, I had lots of things which could be explained both ways. But I think that's also the trouble with the being brainwashed as a child, that you learn from certain age to think on different levels. This is for the outside and this is for me inside, and you have it for the rest of your life. I think people in America, if they're born one way, they sort of tell you as it is. I don't mean like you wouldn't say some things which are rude or whatever, but I mean like you're thinking, like you would be thinking, I don't want to live here, I'm going to live next village or next town, or I'm going to go to West Coast, or the same way you would say, this is what I mean. And the people who experienced this whole sort of macabre situation, they are very much aware how do, and it sort of comes handy, but it's also awfully exhausting.
Sort of the double consciousness.
You have this great example of the airport that you drew.
And it was terrible because I was just the young artist, and I did a record cover which was for somebody who was under a great deal of suspicion because he was involved in 68. He was a singer. He asked me to do the cover. I did one cover, which they said looks decadent to them. So he was an art director. It was fine. It wasn't very much being paid for. They were not like in the Western countries, many record companies. These were just two record companies, and this was one of them. And they asked me to do this cover. And it was a little country airport which used to have these windsocks blowing in the air. And so I painted it, I brought it in, and the man with absolutely serious face said, did you check which side is the wind supposed to blow from? And I started to laugh because I said, this is a joke. And he said, no, this is a very serious question, especially with this singer. And we have to find out if you have the right political story going on here. And I said, what's the political story? He said, well, if you look at the map of Czechoslovakia, West Germany was to the left, or France, or America in that case, and Russia was to the right, or it could be left-wing, right-wing. And he called two ministries, called Ministry of Culture and Ministry of Interior, asking what's the official rules for which side is the wind supposed to blow from. What was interesting, they didn't know right away, so they had to, I don't know where did they have it written down, or if they had to call Moscow. So I sat there, and I could see it's serious, I might not get paid or nothing, and then in 20 minutes, somebody called and he said, you're lucky. Your wind is blowing with the right direction. And just if I was left-handed, I would probably draw it the other way.
Yeah.
Because you'd have the choice. You'd have the sock pointing toward Moscow, which meant the wind was coming from the west.
Right.
And that's the wrong direction.
Right.
But yours was pointing toward the west because the wind was coming from
But sometimes you can Moscow. Analyze these things, you know, sometimes it made no sense whatsoever.
Sure. You, as a bilingual person, when you are working on the text for a book like this, how do you think the fact that you know Czech, that you know that language, affects how the words come out?
Well, it's very nice of you to say I'm a bilingual person. Unfortunately, I don't think I am. That's why this book also has got so many pictures, and so all my books, really, because I do write things in English now, but my English is so limited. If I talk to my 15-year-old daughter, she knows so many big words, and that frustrates me because in Czech I can write beautiful things, but now I reach the point after 25 years I don't do that because some things, it's just impossible to. So with my own book on Charles Darwin, I remember when I've seen the Czech translation and I thought, wow, this is really good, and I had a different way of comprehending that language because I grew up with that language. So I think what some people say, why do you put so much detail in your pictures? I think my pictures became for me the way of writing. If I can't make a very rich sentence, I try to say it in the different layers of the drawing. And then somehow I have to come up with the text to explain what I meant. So that's why I have just like one line.
But do you find some things in Czech that are untranslatable?
Yes. It's two things. One thing is the language, and the other thing is the way of thinking and way of the humor. It's just very difficult. And with here, it's a third aspect is the history. And if I showed this book to anybody who had my experience, and I have few friends, of course, who live here all over the world who lived through the same times, they all say it's the most terrible book they ever seen. They say, this wasn't like this at all. And then you realize it depends if somebody was suffering much more because his father was in prison for 20 years or somebody thinks, and they think I'm doing a hatchet job and something I shouldn't have talked about it at all. But I think that's also very important because this book should be coming out in Czech, an extended version by about 8 pages, that what happened after 1989, and it was a very tough decision by Václav Havel, was the are the people who caused all this be held responsible. And because he's a philosopher and humanitarian, he said, no, we have to keep on going. And I think he was even so sort of Christian that he invited the people who were holding him in prison and gave them some jobs in his security to show that he doesn't hold any grudges. And this thing is coming up over and over again, and same in Poland, same in Hungary. And after all, you have Putin, who's a colonel of KGB, being president. And I think this has to be dealt with because I think it's still lurking because after 1989, people who were in power, they had so much advantage to get into positions and because other people are broken and disoriented. Mm-hmm. Until today, you have all these countries coming out every now and then that this person was working with secret police, that person. And it's still there. And when I come back to Prague, people say, oh, these politicians are terrible. But then I said, now you vote for him. You are the ones who, this is not like in old days, but they say, yeah, but it's still sort of orchestrated. And then it's even new theory now, which is absolutely dreadful, that the communists, when they could see that the whole system is coming down, sort of reinvented themselves into this new society and became successful capitalists. But it's very true that whole society, for many people, they don't talk about it. They don't want to deal with it. This was something which was, and what's getting even more amazing is that now it's becoming part of nostalgia.
The Soviet, the communist nostalgia.
No, but they ask me, like in interviews, even like the French say, well, despite all the oppression and suffering, don't you remember fondly some of those days? And if somebody would be saying, do you remember your first date? Wasn't it nice? Or was it, and he would say, well, I was young, that was nice. But if I look back, that I was behind. I have a friend who's a famous or wonderful Czech writer who was in Auschwitz as a 16, 17-year-old man. And he wrote lots of stories how he fell in love in Auschwitz. But it still was, he might be sorry now because he's 85 that he's not 17, but he was in Auschwitz. I mean, so I don't understand.
Kind of a trade-off there, yeah.
And even like some of my friends who lived there, and then they say, well, you can write a book about it, but we were suffering here till the end, and you were not. So I have a picture of somebody flying above the wall, which for me was a symbol of like that the inspiration and imagination and art can lift you up. And they see it like I'm running away while they stay behind and suffer. So I think it's very hard to be dealing with something which happened to lots of people because everybody has a different memory of that.
We'll be looking further at growing up behind the Iron Curtain and the graphic novel and Peter Cies when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air.
The news, the music, the discussions you hear on Wisconsin Public Radio often trigger a need for more information. It's available from WPR's Audience Services, 1-800-747-7444.
He loved to draw what he was told, didn't question, wasn't told, censored, snooping, shortages, brainwashing, slowly started to question. Tanks, troops, nightmares, dreams, worse and worse, injustice, corruption, lies, suspicion. He dreamed of being free. Trust, equality, dignity, justice. The wall fell and dreams come true. That's a poem by Natalie, age 14, a reader in Chicago who gave that poem to our guest, Peter Cies. I'm Emily Auerbach with Norman Gilliland. This is University of the Air, and we're talking to Peter Cies, who is the author of The Wall, Growing Up Behind the Iron Curtain, And Peter Cease is an internationally acclaimed illustrator, author, and filmmaker born in Czechoslovakia. We never talked about what got you here to America and the whole story of the Olympics.
After, like, having all the experiences with the visual art, I decided to go into film because film has got that element of movement which gave me more opportunity to hide, not to get in trouble. And I did my first professional film, which was eventually banned, and I did a film which won Berlin Film Festival, and through that I got all of a sudden interest from producers outside of the communist bloc, and I did film in Switzerland, I did film in London, and finally I was invited to come to Los Angeles in 1982 to make a little film with other animators from all over the world, which would be like a celebration or jingles or whatever for Olympic Games, which were held in Los Angeles, Summer Olympic Games in 84. And so I came to Los Angeles, I had a visa for 3 months. I didn't take anything with me, thinking I would be back, and I started to work on this film for Olympic Games. And because of some contacts of the people who did it, and they knew my Berlin film, they knew people which were just starting to prepare this new channel called MTV. An MTV producer asked me to do a song for Bob Dylan from his Slow Train Coming record called You Got to Serve Somebody. And for me, as a person who was involved with music, and I just saw it's a dream come true. I'm in America, and Bob Dylan wants me to do his song, and it's this company called MTV. So I'm working on this little film for Olympic Games and starting to make sketches for Bob Dylan when I get a cable that I have to immediately return to Prague because the Soviet bloc countries decided to pull out of the Olympics. I think it was that whole thing with retaliation for Afghanistan when Americans pull out of Moscow and the Russians wanted to do the same thing. But they didn't know that I'm making this film for Bob Dylan. So I thought it's my life's chance that so many times I did return when they told me and that I finish it and be able to explain why I did it. And I finished it and the film wasn't so much liked that they would be jumping for joy. And all of a sudden I felt like, oh my God, because what people again don't realize living in the free country, that if you traveled from the Soviet system country, you need a permission to travel. And they gave you permission for a certain number of days. And if you didn't return in that certain number of days, you were in some sort of trouble. Either they would take away your passport, you would never travel again. But if you return weeks or even like months later, then you could even end up in prison. And if you didn't return in like a year, they realize what's happening, that you're never coming back. So then you would be sentenced to whatever was the, there was some rule for it. So it was like 2 years for the unlawful departure from the Republic. And then they would come and confiscate whatever you left behind. So that's what happened to me, that I was in Los Angeles and I wanted to go back, but I thought I have nothing to justify my late coming and probably would be in trouble. So I thought, first I have to accomplish something and then I can come back to show for it or just try to probably bribe somebody or something. And it took me till now, and, you know, so I was proving it for a long time until 1989 when I became citizen really a few months before the wall came down and Czechoslovakia became free again.
Maybe your most famous, generally speaking, most famous image came from about that time, from 1984, I suppose.
Right.
The poster that you did for the film Amadeus with that very ominous-looking commendatore looking right over with the broad hat.
But that's one of those things when people see it, they say, oh, you did it.
Yes.
So it is like the most famous, but nobody knows I did it. Because in that time I was penniless in Los Angeles and Maurice Sendak, the famous children book illustrator and author, called me because someone sent him my art and he said, if you want to do books, because he thought I want to do books, I wasn't quite sure, but I was broke. So he said, then you have to come to the East Coast to the publishers. And I didn't know how to get there. I had no means, but in that moment, Miloš Forman called and asked me to make this poster. So I did a poster, and for the money I got for the poster, I bought an old car and drove across the country to New York.
And if you're sitting on an airplane and somebody says, so what do you do? How do you describe yourself these days?
It's so difficult. It's so hard.
Unless you travel with one of your books.
Well, not really. But if you start to get into that whole, I'm a children book author, it's just so misleading. Because it's like when we live in this small town outside of New York, and I go to my studio in Manhattan, but we are in the small town, I notice that if you are in children's books, like if you go to any party, it's always somebody who says, oh, this is my wife, and she just wrote a children's story. Would you have a time next week to illustrate it? And you're like, if I was a carpenter, you wouldn't ask me to make you like a chair. And I think that's the misconception which goes to like when people say, what age group is it for? Because we think in our head, like children's book is something about teddy bear or like a little squirrel or something, and we don't give kids enough credit. And then I was always thinking like, well, if you today would bring Little Prince or maybe even for sure, I mean, Anne Frank, people would say, is this, but these are all important stories, Diary of Anne Frank or Alice in Wonderland. All these things are rather complex. And yet we somehow, in our rush and sort of like looking back at children, go like, oh, children's books, that's just... So it's very funny when people say, well, he's in children's books, but he's really on the more sophisticated side. And he also did the mosaic for the subway, and he also... So MacArthur is pretty good because people know it's called Genius Award. So they start to say, so how are you doing, genius? And then they know they know there's money attached to it. So they always get impressed by this. So what did you with you? How did you invest your money? And little they know that money's gone and I didn't invest in anything.
Well, didn't Jacqueline and Kennedy Onassis call you a genius?
Yeah, that's true. That's true. I forgot about that's another claim to fame that I work with Jacqueline Kennedy Onassis. Yeah.
And do you worry ever that your book, because you have in the text and in the illustrations, America to the rescue, happiness and color and liberty and justice coming in as the West comes into the East, do you ever worry that American readers will read this almost as American propaganda and not
related? Absolutely. That's your first person who brought it up, but that's scary in the way because it's a little ironic for me. And it's a little ironic in the way that I could completely understand the beginning of the war in Iraq. I thought that if this had happened to us in 1968, we would have been so happy that somebody's coming to the rescue. And in that time, I think there was one speech in the United Nations, and then it was sort of nobody would touch it because there was no oil in Czechoslovakia, and this was done deal. And the same thing, as I read now in 1956, happened in Hungary when they were made believe that somebody's coming to help. And you're absolutely right. This is a little ironic because if I look at it back now, we were absolutely elated that the Beach Boys are coming 10 months after the Soviet invasion. But in the way it was absurd because anybody who was an astute politician or must have seen what's coming. So this was almost like saying they would still play to us and it was wonderful. And we thought, oh, things will not change that much. But it was sort of false pretext, really. And that's part of it. And I don't know how many people will understand that little bit of the bitterness. It was another part of doing this book that I discovered what was going in America in the 50s and all that. But that would be just such a complex project. And I couldn't possibly... One thing I found which was the same for Americans and the Czechoslovaks of that time was that everybody was hiding under the table rehearsing for the nuclear war, which shows how stupid it was.
Yes. If you were to write a book about Czechoslovakia today, about life in Prague, what would it be like?
That would be very difficult because it's almost Prague. I don't know. The Prague I remember is the Prague which was sort of gray and empty streets and cobblestones, in the rain. And now it's full of tourists. And also what I just realized, what I think, I don't know even if the Czechs realize that the center of Prague is so touristy and it will be like Florence or Paris touristy forever. And who moved in are sort of international restaurants and people who are taking advantage. The hotels are more expensive, I think, than in New York. And it became a place to make money. And I'm happy I did a book about Prague, Three Golden Keys, when I have no people and you just see the streets. And what I do if I come back to Prague is I wait when the tourists go to eat in the evening and then you can start to roam the empty streets and you go to the Prague Castle and it's absolutely empty. And then it's magic because then it's timeless. But I think I wouldn't be probably doing a book about Prague today. No.
Peter Sees, thanks for breaking down some walls.
Thank you very much.
I'm Emily Auerbach with Norman Gilliland, hoping you can join us for the next hour of University of the Air.